This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm just going to say a few words. I think it was very interesting from the first session, a few things that came up that Keller was discussing duplication, and this is interesting to me because this sense that the evasion is something that is itself and also something outside of itself, which I think may come up on presentation as well, the outside, and also that there was a replication that Manuel discussed in his presentation of the refugee camps, of the camp replicating, not the city, but within itself, some aspects of a market or a city. And those are things I think that may come up also in the institution session. And in this session, we're looking a bit at the ways that evasions operate either within institutions or the ways that institutions operate evasively. And that this is a bit of the moment where the evasion, the evasive moves to become pervasive, that the evasion is kind of normalized, perhaps. That's one way maybe of looking at this situation. And let's see, I'm just going to skip down because I want to move right into the presentations. But one thing I wanted to identify is an artistic practice, since there aren't many artists here on the panels today, and I feel a little bit like I want to bring that voice in. That there are a series of artistic practices in which artists are kind of pointing specifically to these evasions of the system. And Jill Maggott is an artist based in New York, and she is specifically doing this in her recent project that's been commissioned by the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. And there's an image here on the screen from that project in which she points out the evasion of systems of the infrastructure and of security systems in the New York City subway. And the way she addresses this evasion is with complete directness. So in the New York City subways, if you know, there's always a sign that says, "You may be searched at random." And this is how the structure kind of underscores that you're free, because in fact you are subject to their search, to the structure's search, and therefore you should kind of enjoy the fact that you're free, because in fact you're subjected. And what she does is she preempts this randomness of the system and directly goes and asks a police officer to please search her. And at that point, the police officer and she become engaged in an interaction that goes on for about 4 months, in which she becomes trained as a police officer. And so this is the police officer, Fred, and she rejects the idea that the system of the law can be indifferent. And so she inserts emotional relationship into the system. And so for 4 months, they exchange knowledge. And this is him, and then the other image. It's kind of an intimate image for a policeman. And the other image is of his date book, in which he logs every time that they meet. So with that, I just want to move to all of the information and people that we have on the panel today. I'm going to announce people in alphabetical order, but the order is going to be different. Anselm Frank is a curator and writer based in Antwerp and Berlin, and right now he's the director of Extra City Center for Contemporary Art in Antwerp. And Sarah Herda is the executive director of the Graham Foundation for Advanced Studies in the Fine Arts. It's based in Chicago. And David Kazanjian teaches in the English department here at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's working on American literary and historical studies in the 19th century, specifically. Thomas Keenan is the director of the Human Rights Project and an associate professor of comparative literature at Bard College in New York. And John Palmazzino is the head of research at Etaha Zurich Studio in Basel. And also, he is a principal of territorial agency as well in Basel. So with that, I'm going to ask John to begin. And again, as people have questions, please, or comments, just to speak to the timekeeper or be ready to ask it right after. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear? Can you hear? Yeah.
Yes.
I would like to put forth a couple of issues that I think could relate with the link between institutions, especially international institutions, and the evasion of power. And I would like to talk today about a difficult and controversial node in the international law, and that is the law of neutrality. And neutrality is clearly defined. It doesn't mean it doesn't need any large definitions, but you can understand neutrality as being the state of not being on either of the two sides that are contending, or even be related to those. So it is a state that is clearly outside of a conflict, and it's a situation that could be interesting to look at in terms of territorial transformations. I would like to start with a map. If you could go back to this map. And this is a map of a scenario that is currently being debated in international context. As you know, last week, 15 sailors of the British Navy have been captured by Iran. And the controversy is about where exactly they've been captured. Was it in Iraqi territorial waters, or was it in Iranian territorial waters? The place which we are talking about is in the lower rectangle, number 02 in the map. And mind you, so the old controversy is if the British soldiers were seized on that side of the line or on that side of the line. And it's a very important question, because it refers to basically the law of war. And we are dealing here with international laws of war. And I'm showing you this because I had a conversation last week with Eyal, and he was phoning me and telling me to look into the work of Grotius, the inventor of the idea of the open seas and the idea of the neutrality of seas. And the notion of neutrality is interesting, an idea that comes from the waging of war. It's not an idea of being outside war, but it's actually an idea that to control war and to navigate through it. And basically, it's an idea that the merchant cities in Europe started to elaborate, okay, in order to go about with the commerces, in order to maintain the fleets and maintain the commerces in spite of the power of other cities that would overtake them. So we could consider that the right of war at one point was simply the right of the stronger, the right to seize and capture the other. There was no room for being outside. There was no room for weakness. You could only keep what you could hold. Can you go back one, please? Now I would like to, since we are very tight on our schedule, to skip a couple of hundred years from Grotius and go back. And no, can you keep it there, please? And also change from altitude 0 to altitude 2000. And this is an image which is, I think, central to the development of the notion of neutrality and, and its territorial implications. It's the construction of what is called in Switzerland the Devil's Bridge. And it's the bridge that basically invented the direct route between North and South Europe on the Gotthard. And it is almost impossible to surpass the Schöllenen Gorge, and this bridge was an invention of control of nature. Can you go on now, please? Can you please go on? Quickly. So the idea of being neutral and being connected with international trades and routes is connected with an idea of managing and controlling a territorial entity, and especially managing and controlling nature. This is a series of images that you're seeing in the background by Armin Linke, who is analyzing how in the Swiss polytechnical schools the incredible attempt to control even how fog is going through, deploying through the Alps. I'm showing you these images because the idea of the territory linked with an idea of neutrality is completely connected with an idea of stasis, of maintaining a situation which is not dynamic, eliminating chance, eliminating every kind of abrupt change. This is a map that shows the borders of Switzerland in lighter white, and again in white, a series of international moments where conventions or moments of negotiation have been taking place in order to control a larger moment of conflicts that are on an international base. Can you go on, please? The Swiss idea of neutrality is not an idea of the extent and the complete extent of the territory or the land, or better, the extension of the horizon of the oceans. It's rather a situation of enclosure. It's a situation of constructing clear and separated borders that demarcate its being inside a neutral space and outside a complete open space for to wage wars between empires. Can you go on quickly? I would like now to show you some very quickly, please, like 1 or 2 seconds. Some images of Geneva, and can you go on? Geneva is a very interesting place in this context because it is at the same time a city-state and it is an international location. It's at the same time completely controlled in a sort of a village social control by its inhabitants and the seat of a large number of international institutions. The idea of Geneva being like a place where these treaties and negotiations can take place, I think it's very interesting, especially if we consider it in its extraterritorial condition. That is, it is not a situation that is based on a control of the entire territory, but it's rather a situation that devises itself exactly as being a system of powers that relate only to management, only to the situation that is basically linking polities and nations and states rather than its territory. So at the same time, it's an extremely calm and tranquil city on the Lake of Leman, and the seat of this almost universal space for the deployment of international conflicts. It is also the seat of the branch of the United Nations that relates to human rights. And this is not a chance. As you know, human rights are one of the most important parts of the United Nations, and they somehow find their origin also in the incredible idea of the Red Cross, which is the inverted flag of Switzerland. That is the idea that the neutral flag will protect you from the wages of war in order to go about in saving the wounded and the... I have now only 1 minute, and so I will skip very rapidly through centuries back again. Can you quickly jump? Quickly. Can you keep scrolling very quickly? These are images of the... can you just... I skip this one. The United Nations were invented in 1941 before the attack on Pearl Harbor on a boat and it on a ship off the coast of Nova Scotia. Between Roosevelt and Churchill, there was this idea that there had to be a plan in order to wage war to the Nazi, to the complete evil. And it is very interesting that the idea of the United Nations is not an idea of only assembling nations and in order to organize their civil whereabouts, but it's a plan of war. After Second World War, the United Nations started being mainly the seat of the negotiations through of the Second War, of the Cold War. That is a completely aterritorial war based on the missile possibility of destroying each other. Can you go quickly?
Maybe you could just add a concluding sentence.
I will now show you, as a conclusion, a series of maps that show the international deployment of international forces of the UN. And all of these are an idea of implementation of the World Without Borders of human rights, of the universe of humanity. And it's interesting to notice how clearly they refer to a neutral space, a space of safety. And it is, again, a territorial space. It is very similar to the landlocked isolation of Switzerland. It's a series of buffer zones and enclaves which control the network of the implementation of this world without borders. Some of these, of course, function. Others are a way of introducing a very evil moment of moderating and mitigating territorial transitions. And especially, for instance, if you look at this map, that is where the war in Lebanon started last summer. Go on, please. Or if you think of the safe area in Srebrenica in the 90s, where the free zones were sort of a deployment of a very slow motion genocide. We see that the idea of neutrality being linked with, on one side, an idea of international and perpetual peace is also an idea that is linked with a constant waging of war.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. Is there anyone from the floor who has a question at this particular juncture? And just if, as you think of questions, just tell the timekeeper. Otherwise, we can just, I think we'll just keep moving along so that people can, we can have some discussion at the end. Thanks. So, Anselm, I'd like to move to you. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Maybe in what I'm going to do, I think, is trying to inhabit exactly that space kind of in between Sanjay Krishnan's a little bit displaced, apologies for that remark, presentation within the series of other contributions to the last panel. And but before I will quickly, you know, kind of describe you the situation out of which I would ask those questions that will follow. Since 3 months, I'm responsible for the programming and, in fact, kind of setting up of an institution that is kind of following the ICA, the more and more global ICA model in the city of Antwerp, which, as some of you may know or may not know, is was a city with an incredible history as a city that has had a very important port for centuries, a city that has been under various rule, probably like no other city in Europe, and a city that is today marked by both having kind of having to suffer from an extremely kind of segregated situation and very little concepts how to deal with the problems arising from that, and a shockingly high percentage of far right wing voters, so that at the last election of the mayor in Antwerp, all cultural institutions in the city actually agreed to, a few days before the elections, to collectively kind of get the fire alarm on, something that was initiated by an artist living in the town, living in the city, Luke Timmons, which was very efficient in terms of you know, it being a media campaign. Now, what I'm doing is, at the moment, I don't really have, let's say, a claim or an argument, but more a set of questions. As I kind of happen I try to articulate really the expectations that I meet. So kind of the delineation of what an institution an institute or an institution for of contemporary art in a city such as Antwerp may be. So just like before I come along with my own idea of that. Within these expectations, I would almost say that the first layer is that the ICA model, and that may relate to some of the remarks at the opening, kind of is almost seen as, you know, very naively as a free space, no? Like whatever that is, yeah? But there's the idea that you can do things there that, you know, elsewhere you cannot do, or something is more free there than elsewhere. Huh? And in the second step, or the second layer, is that somehow everything that cannot happen elsewhere is consequently believed to be rightly placed in there. That means the lack of dialogue between the kind of parties which in the troubled country of Belgium kind of try to reinvent their own kind of stories, legitimizing a certain kind of identity politics, and the other half of the population, because it's really half, which lives in kind of various communities, has very little access to the institutions. It's I would kind of describe the situation of immigrants in Belgium almost as clinical, meaning that what rules is apathy to, in between those communities. Now, there's a lot of kind of talking around, you know, the role of cultural institutions in having to be diverse, intercultural, all that, which really poses the problem for me. Kind of how will I respond to that in the next couple of years and in the design of that space as a conceptual space, which I believe this institute or this institution, which is really somehow, you know, a Kunsthalle, should be. I was doing a project on gesture last year, and I somehow share probably with Keller, among the other people in the room, the most this kind of belief in, you know, the usefulness of theatrical, of a kind of reference to theater or even the carnivalesque. Now, when you research gesture, and that project actually took place in a theater as an exhibition in a theater about theater, when you research gesture, you come along a lot of projects that kind of try to semioticize the gesture, right? To, you know, you have a lot of failed projects that in the end make something like a dictionary of gestures, right? And it's interesting in the way in which they fail to do so, right? Because somehow the gesture, you lack everything, kind of any kind of dynamic understanding of gesture, which, you know, you need as, let's say, a performer, but as well as a performer in the rhythm of what we could call the rhythm of everyday life, if you try to, you know, kind of assemble, let's say, in different cultures, that gesture means that and that. The whole point about gesture is the background, right? That the attitude, like something that when you break it down to movement research and things that have been done in research around dance, would take place in the spine, right? Or something that within Brechtian theory could be described as attitude. No, in a way, Brecht could be seen as somebody transferring the idea of the intellectual montage from Eisenstein into the context of from film to human beings. No, so human beings are montaged within a certain background or a certain framing condition, and that is then the result or the attitude on which the gesture actually unfolds and becomes meaningful. Is what he calls the gestus, but I think we can simply run with the question of attitude. I find that very interesting because somehow the whole tradition in which I believe a place like a Center for Contemporary Art still works is the very idea of exhibiting is somehow related to the idea of background explication, right? You would always find mechanisms in like the whole idea of progress within, you know, that part of the culture of exhibiting that is connected to knowledge. We kind of skip the other, the darker, purely aesthetic side for a second. I'll return to that later. But that one, which is connected to knowledge, is connected to explicating that what is in the background, not the making the implicit explicit, kind of bringing the background into the foreground. That would be a very simple model of, or simplified model of progress in history of the exhibition format. Now, in a way, that connects a lot with a certain kind of hypnotizing function of that which appears within a frame, and that is something I believe until today. Is something very, very strong in kind of the unspeakable conditions that the very frame of the medium exhibition itself, before you have added anything to it, brings with it, right? I mean, this is kind of the stage that is the exhibition, is largely determined by that hypnotizing function of that which is made apparent, explicit. And it is very difficult to actually still see the frame as a relational device, right? So it somehow reminds me, when you kind of translate it into a more political context, of problems that appear within the discussion around political correctness, right? Dialogue would always be great. let's say, now I'm supposed to kind of stand in for the dialogue in Belgium that, you know, elsewhere doesn't take place. I have to take care of that now. But the very conditions of the dialogue cannot really be negotiated, right? So I wonder, like, the whole problem, and that's really where I see the connection between Sanjay's comment on the kind of, you know, like looking at the framing or how are these images brought to us kind of question rather than what is actually made evident by them. The whole question is how does the dialogue that can take place within a certain frame or on a certain stage relate to the very conditions, or in to what degree can the stage itself become negotiated by the dialogue that takes place? I mean, I think actually, in the end, what is dialogue if not the very negotiations of the conditions under which it takes place? Now, and I will close already with that. I think it's very symptomatic in the field of art at the moment. There's been a book published by Doug Aitken, who, and I use this example now because this has been this major facade project in New York City at the MoMA with the very symptomatic title it's Broken Screen, but the subtitle is actually what I wanted to use here is breaking the expanding the image, breaking the narrative. Somehow I believe that what happened to the art institution, but within the within art, meaning the aesthetic field itself, since the 70s is exactly what Doug Aitken refers to, although the original intention of that kind of heritage to which he in a way appropriates. Basically, the book is a series of interviews with important figures of experimental film, underground film, and later video art, is exactly to in the kind of breaking of the narrative, you would kind of undo framing conditions, right? And the framing conditions were mainly the way in which genre conventions in aesthetics would relate to social order, right? Now, what happened in these three and a half decades since then is that, and this is exactly the globalizing process, I believe. There is a globalization of the image as well. And the narrative has been broken to the degree that each little bit of narrative is valid, to the degree it can become a fetish, right? So basically what I'm trying to... I have to wrap up, so I cannot really tell the story anymore, but the point that I would actually had to is to turn around that phrase, right? I mean, what I believe has to be done in institutions in order to counter that kind of, as I believe, false assumptions of a freedom that actually is absolutely unoperable, is a fake freedom, is a kind of something that exists only as the, as a wording dialogue, but actually no dialogue that can negotiate the frame, is, we have to turn around that frame, right? We have to break the image and expand the narrative. Thanks.
Again, I'll ask if there's anything from the floor in particular. I'm going to just keep moving on. Okay, if not, so I'd like to ask Tom now to continue. Thanks.
What I'd like to do is actually show my little video clip first. I don't have a whole lot to say, so I want to use up some of the time by showing a video. Okay, so before you play it, let me set it up. This is a videotape straight out of Iraq, straight out of the jihad, made by it's called the Al-Furqan Media Production Organization, which is the official public relations arm of the so-called Islamic State of Iraq, which is the successor organization to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's Al-Qaeda in Iraq organization. And because this was an architecture conference, sort of, I wanted to have a little bit of an architectural theme. So you'll recognize maybe a trope, ultimately, from other videotapes that you've seen in this video. This chronicles an event that happened in Fallujah about 2 weeks ago. The tape arrived through the network, which I want to talk about in my little tiny talk, a couple of days ago. So you can play it, Aaron. Thank you.
وحولوا صبحهم نارا
I hope you can see it, but there's a bunch of men running around in front of that building. I think we're actually missing a channel of the sound. There's somebody talking now. You have to imagine a guy giving a talk. He's explaining that this building is the headquarters in this part of Fallujah of the Iraqi National Guard. Why the thing you're about to see is going to happen. Appreciate how long you're being made to wait.
فلوجة صارت لي أملا فلوجة أختا أبناء عراق لا تهنوا أبناء معاذ والقعقاع
The first logo was the logo of the media organization. The second logo is the logo of the state. Okay. So that sort of videotape is produced in a... let me start that again. I offer that just as an example. Excellent. I'm starting with 5 minutes. I offer that just as an example of the flow of the absolutely regular, daily, multiply daily flow of, as you can see, high quality, high production quality videotapes direct from the front line of a present holding conflict, and that's the I just offer it just as a token of a network effect, a network media effect. That I want to talk about very quickly. So back to the topic here. I wanted to kind of state something that is maybe too obvious about the title and the overall project of this day, but I don't think anybody said it yet, so maybe it's not entirely obvious. It feels to me like the title, with that of in it, oscillates between two kind of fantasy states or two kind of dreams or two desires. On the one hand, it suggests that maybe evading power is possible. And so against that, or I would oppose to that, simply the claim that there is no evading or avoiding power at least power as such. There are no innocent margins in which power does not somehow contaminate subjects, even constitute subjects. So that notion of evasion of power has a certain dreamlike quality. On the other hand, you could say that there are nothing but evasions of power, and that meeting power face to face, having it not hide itself, having it not engage in its evasions, is equally a dream. That it would be dreamy to meet power in person, to finally figure out where the power is, and be able to, whatever, deal with it, confront it, challenge it, make friends with it. But in that sense, that's a dream as well. Power is always an evasive project. So whether you approach it from the one side, I want to evade power and its clutches, or power is an evasive project, I think there's a kind of a symmetrical fantasy there. So just to formalize that, because I found myself wondering what exactly an evasion was as I was thinking about coming here. The opposite would be, that's a simple binary thinker, the opposite would be confronting power or the transparency of power or directness of power or power which admits that it's power, power which enables some kind of face-to-face exposure or something like that. All of that, I think, doesn't happen. So we could say there aren't any evasions or there are nothing but evasions, and that might amount to saying there are only different forms or different representations or different diversions or different deviations or maneuvers or reroutings of power. And that would be simply translated as there are only mediations of power. Power is only a phenomenon of mediation. And the way that power is exercised changes with the ways that it's mediated. There's the tiny theoretical preamble. Here's the example. One form, one contemporary form of power, heralded as a kind of breakthrough, would be the non-governmental organization, the moment of whether it's neutrality or the moment of the refugee camp or in a slightly deviant form, Keller's extra state organizations. There is something like today an exercise of power which doesn't pass through the mechanism, traditionally through the mechanism of the state. We could call it without borderism, whether it's humanitarians or human rights organizations or the famine movement or whatever. And that is a phenomenon which is decisively associated with the media. Let me just read to you as an exemplary quotation, something from an essay by Michael Ignatieff about 20 years ago. Commenting on the famine movement and on the birth of the NGO movement. He says, television is the instrument of a new kind of politics. Television is there standing in for generally the phenomenon of publicity and media. Since 1945, affluence and idealism have made possible the emergence of a host of non-governmental private charities and pressure groups that use television as a central part of their campaigns to mobilize conscience and money on behalf of endangered humans and their habitats around the world. And you can spell it out, and it's not too hard to figure out, that NGOs have a special relation, not being organizations, strictly speaking, of political representation. They have a special relation to TV and alternate forms of representation. That was heralded by many people as a kind of amazing breakthrough, finally challenging the power of the state and evading the power of the state in a way. And a great deal of really interesting politics has come out of that. There is a kind of a fondness, utopian desire for that politics today, which manifests itself in the, around the nickname civil society, and a lot of organizations devoted and a lot of money spent to the propagation of civil society. I offer you that videotape and everything that it stands in for, this incredible global network nicknamed the Jihad, as a kind of a an attempt at a bracing counterexample, that all the conditions of the human rights, formal conditions of the human rights movement, of the non-governmental politics movement, of the humanitarians, the dream of a transnational, borderless community governed only not by the desire to take power, but by the desire to improve the world and the condition of at least some humans in it, all of that has been realized now on the internet with videotapes like that, a genuine global transnational borderless media or community has been produced, and it's called today the Jihad. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, any comments, or we will have time at the end, which is going to be great as well. So now I'd like to ask David to continue. Thanks.
Hi. So probably much to everyone's relief, I won't be talking about the 19th century U.S. today, but rather some other aspects of my research, although the mark of my being an early Americanist is in the fact that I have no technology to show you, so I have a slightly more formal presentation, which has the benefit of keeping me within 10 minutes. So I'd like to talk about the figure of genocide today. In recent years, the term genocide... Can you hear me?
It's good, yes.
The term genocide has been used more and more persistently as a powerful instrument in the realm of geopolitics. It has passed, I think, into the troublesome field of common sense, which is not to say that anyone knows just what genocide means. Quite the opposite. It is to say that we believe we no longer need to think about what genocide means because its meaning has become self-evident. As a result, we are confronted with something akin to what Althusser, in 1946, called the International of Decent Feelings, a consensus among certain post-war intellectuals that one, quote, can avert the fatality of war by conducting an international moral campaign, end quote. To put the catastrophe of World War II to rest, Althusser argued, these intellectuals claimed that Europeans simply needed to acknowledge their shared, abstractly universal humanity. Continuing with Althusser, quote, if this mentality is international and in the process of taking institutional form, then a new international is in the making. There is perhaps something to be gained from trying to discover what it conceals, end quote. On the occasion of the mass killing that seems still to be defining our 21st century moment, Althusser's essay prompts us to raise some questions about the discourse of genocide as a way of understanding such killing. So I have two questions to begin with. What and how does the institutionalized discourse of genocide conceal? And quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, I'll give you an answer up front. The institutionalized discourse of genocide conceals the human by entombing it, which is the same as saying that the institutionalized discourse of genocide civilizes the human by entombing the inhuman. So let me elaborate on that. In Sophocles' play Antigone, Creon, the king of Thebes, issues a proclamation forbidding the city to dignify his nephew Polynices with burial, to mourn him at all, because Polynices chose to fight and die on behalf of Argos against Thebes. But Polynices' sister, Antigone, defies her uncle Creon and insists on burying her brother. To punish Antigone, Creon orders that she be entombed alive. Both Creon and Antigone describe her entombed state as something beyond that even of the metoikos, the resident alien, the non-citizen. She is made a stranger to the living and the dead, to the human itself. In his prohibitions on mourning, then, Creon insists on the state's power to define what counts as the human. In Creon's hand, mourning becomes an instrument of the state, subject to its normative juridical power. Placed beyond the limits of this institutionalized humanity, Antigone goes to her stony vault defiant, saying no to Creon to the end. But she also goes to this prison cut in the hollow rock, raising questions to the end. One of her last utterances is this question, quote, "What law, you ask, do I satisfy with what I say? What law of the mighty gods have I transgressed? Why look to the heavens anymore, tormented as I am? Whom to call, what comrades now?" End quote. She thus comes to figure an evasion of institutional power that takes the form of a refusal, as well as a questioning of the nature of community. She becomes something like an other humanity, a beyond the human that nonetheless lays claim to a certain humanity. As Judith Butler has written, quote, "Antigone is not of the human, but speaks in its language. Prohibited from action, she nevertheless acts, and her act is hardly a simple assimilation to an existing norm. If she is human, then the human has entered into catachresis. We no longer know its proper usage," end quote. I want to suggest that Antigone offers up something of an allegory for the modern conception of genocide, which was defined and promulgated in the 1930s and 40s by Raphael Lemkin, a Jewish refugee from Poland and a legal scholar. Lemkin first tried to make Nazi atrocities subject to international law with the 1933 Madrid proposal, which defined two new international crimes: what he called the offense of barbarism, or the attempted extermination of a racial, religious, or social collectivity, and the offense of vandalism, or the attempted destruction of such a collectivity's cultural or artistic works. When this proposal failed to gain international support, he coined a new word that would gather these two offenses into one crime. As he put it in publications from 1944 and 1945, quote, "The crime of the Reich in wantonly and deliberately wiping out whole peoples is not utterly new in the world. It is only new in the civilized world, as we have come to think of it. It is so new in the traditions of civilized man that he has no name for it. It is for this reason that I took the liberty of inventing the word, genocide. It required a long period of evolution in civilized society to mark the way from wars of extermination, which occurred in ancient times and in the Middle Ages, to the conception of wars as being essentially limited to activities against armies and states. In the present war, however, genocide is widely practiced by the German occupant," end quote. In Lemkin's foundational conception, then, genocide is another word for the crime of being a barbarian, of stepping outside the traditions of civilized man, in a way no European power before Nazi Germany had done since the Middle Ages. We can see quite quickly that the term genocide is itself marked by the unspoken violence of civility. By skipping from the Middle Ages to Nazi Germany without mentioning the catastrophic European violence of slavery and colonialism, Lemkin effaces that violence. To link the Middle Ages with Nazi Germany, Lemkin's account must place the lives of Africans, indigenous Americans, and Asians beyond the human, entombing them as barbarians whose deaths are unrelated to the traditions of civilized man. His text shows us how the very term genocide functions normatively as a kind of prohibition akin to Creon's law. While genocide claims simply to prosecute the inhuman, the barbarous, like Creon, it in fact defines and delimits the human. Genocide, at its very coinage, conceals the human by entombing it, which is also to say that it civilizes the human by entombing the inhuman. We could call this the work of genocide over and against the work of mourning. This is not an antiquarian point. So let me invoke just one recent instance of the work of genocide, which actually, to my surprise, popped up on the page 3 of the New York Times today, if you had a chance to look at it. On January 19th, as is well known internationally, Hrant Dink was assassinated in Turkey. An Armenian Turk, Dink was the editor-in-chief of a bilingual Turkish-Armenian newspaper in Istanbul and had been prosecuted for writing articles about Turkish-Armenian reconciliation. In effect, he reminded the Turkish state of something that is characteristic of most states, including, for instance, these United States, that it was founded on the as-yet-unmourned mass killing, on mass killing whose mourning itself has, in fact, been interdicted. Dink was a complicated man. Like most of us, he was neither a saint nor a sinner. That his death led Turkish citizens into the streets with signs that read, "We are all Armenians," I admit, touched me in ways I will not try to understand here, because like Antigone, I'm a stranger to Turkey. I will have always been a stranger to Turkey ever since my grandfather was driven out in 1895 leaving behind a land being drenched in catastrophe, in incalculable death without mourning. However, I will urge us to understand how Dink's murder led to a new round of charges from Europe and the U.S. that Turkey was not yet civilized enough for accession to the European Union. Charges echoed by key segments of the Armenian diaspora, who used them to insist yet again monotonally on the recognition, restoration, and reparation from Turkey for the Armenian genocide. Precisely because genocide was, from its foundation, linked to a civilizational discourse, it is so easy for the West to instrumentalize genocide and orientalize Turkey at such a moment, while simultaneously waging brutal wars around the globe, wars inspired, as Fred Moten has recently argued, by a new international of decent feelings, the so-called war on terror. Consequently, it becomes impossible in the West to discuss Dink's own opposition to French laws against uttering denials of the Armenian genocide, or any of his complex accounts of his relationship to Turkey and the Armenian diaspora. Much less is it possible to shift our focus entirely from genocide to something like the provocative definition Tom Keenan offers in his blog for war in our current conjuncture, paraphrasing Tom, if you don't mind. The secret or not so secret image of a world in which both politics and language might be transcended, this is the definition of war, whether in the universality of human rights, the unilateralism of an imposition, or the simple disappearance of opacity, delay, difference, disagreement, and misunderstanding into the clarity and directness of self-erasing speech. End of paraphrase. So my point here is that the institutionalized discourse of genocide conceals the human in its zeal to entomb the inhuman. It effectively limits what we might think by delimiting the human. As a result, complex discussions of our current moment's relationship to mass killing are foreclosed by it. So I'll conclude then with a second set of questions that I'll just offer up for discussion. I have some ideas about them, but I won't give them right now. How might one evade genocide's entombment of the human? And what forms would this evasion take? And what spaces might it occupy? Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great. Now the panelists are throwing out lots of questions. Also, Anselm threw out lots of questions as well. So let's conclude with Sarah and then move into a larger discussion. Go ahead, Sarah.
I think that, can you hear me? Is that, yeah?
Yes.
If a lot of what people are talking about today are spatial products, I think that I want to talk about the products of spatial practices and where they're developed, produced, and disseminated or exchanged. And I think today's event is one of those examples. I also think that there is a kind of dangerous myth of the alternative space or the free space, as maybe Anselm characterized it. And I would actually like to challenge Aaron's opening when he was talking about the kind of nostalgia for the alternative art space movement, you know, as it was manifest in, say, New York in the 60s or 70s. Many of those spaces were actually created with state support. I mean, Artist Space was actually an initiative of the New York State Council on the Arts. Many nonprofits that were acting in direct opposition of, let's say, the gallery system that was a completely different landscape than it is today, was actually seriously aided by the state, by the NEA, by the National Endowment. Places like Storefront, the institution that I was at for the last 8 years, was also a recipient of that support. And in fact, in the very beginning of Storefront, while it was an initiative by individuals, it was kind of institutionalized and sustained by different available funding. And at that time, I think one of the oldest and most loyal funder to Storefront is the New York State Council on the Arts, Architecture, Planning, and Design Department. The bottom fell out of all of that funding. I mean, just at a point where they were trying to increase the capacity of these organizations, all funding from the government, kind of the bottom fell out, and you lost a lot of these spaces. I'm not saying that this characterizes every alternative space, but I think that some of them that we, you know, that still exist now actually came from this system. So I'm actually really interested now in in how do you create the capacity for an alternate? I mean, for an alternative space or sort of a defiant organization. I think, in fact, it's a myth that it's not operating within the same system as some of the institutions that many find themselves critiquing. I mean, there, you know, all of the organizations here today. We have development and finance issues. We have marketing and publicity issues. I mean, there are a lot of aspects of capacity that we cannot ignore, and that, for me, I think it's less maybe. I'm not necessarily that alternative is not is often not viable completely, or as it's. Many of these institutions, in fact, are not effective and can't therefore efficiently support the ideas that people are developing, need to be produced, and need to be kind of disseminated in a much broader field. So I have actually, I would like to talk about that maybe in this context. Because I think that there's often a real burden in being alternative, in that you have to know very well the system in which you're working, and to create an alternative to it. And you also, I think that you have to identify the different constituencies that you have and the different audiences. I mean, I think forums at all scales are not only important but essential. Like the kind of private enclave of a discussion we might have here today, and then the different products of that and the ways in which they're made public. And I think that we also have very little support within our field. I'm speaking more specifically of architecture. And I think projects like Laura's also exemplify where the funding, a large part of that funding, came from outside of the discipline. Right? It's a, and I think that we need to find ways where, I mean, maybe the new institutions are the, maybe again, like today, through collaboration, you're creating a different forum to reach a different audience or create a different discussion to, you know, to exercise power and influence. I mean, I think we actually need to build much more powerful institutions. So, leave it at that.
In what way do you think of a more powerful institution? How are you?
I think a lot of the spaces that are producing the most interesting work suffer from complete lack of capacity and therefore completely marginalizing the work that's being shown there. It's kind of ghettoized. So it doesn't, the real impact of those ideas and the influence it could have, they're not sort of at the right table to exert that influence, to kind of have an exchange beyond just maybe your small peer group. I mean, there are things like, the New Urbanists, the Congress for New Urbanists, is an incredible model of operation. I mean, they wanted to have the sort of maximum influence. I mean, you know, whatever you think of the mission there or the statement or what's being exercised, you know, they knew where to set up their operations to have influence. I mean, they co-opted these systems of power to be at the table to exert influence. So they have press conferences on Capitol Hill. I mean, I think that a lot of the work that's being discussed today is obviously has, I think that these institutions, educational institutions, alternative spaces, are the leaders in what will, affect maybe the discipline or the profession at large. But there are different ways, there are different places to communicate, to kind of deliver your work in different ways. I mean, I think you have to be able to talk to your peers and to have a kind of private conversation, and then you have to be able to contextualize your work within, another realm that you might be able to have more impact and to be relentless about it. That it's, that at Storefront there was a strange thing that happened that everyone, when I got there, I started inviting, I expanded sort of the mailing list in the most sort of ridiculous and straightforward ways. And people, like these kind of bigger architectural firms or different people, started coming to Storefront, which they'd never been there. And I started to get invited to things like the New Visions. What is it called? New Visions in New York, or it was this consortium of, I can't even remember the name. New York New Visions, and it was this consortium of nonprofit organizations to sort of deal with the aftermath of 9/11. And Storefront, as a representative of Storefront, I was at that table. Mm-hmm. So there are ways in which, and also the mayor's Design Excellence Initiative, there are ways in which if you participate in these larger systems, you know, you also have to be responsible and sort of show up and.
So do you think part of that is you're mentioning the mailing list, so in a way disseminating a kind of key issue for making a more powerful institution would be disseminating yourself in a way, disseminating what the institution does.
But also like assuming some authority. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You have things that you have to assert and sort of assume authority to be at those tables.
Well, that there are a few things that come to mind about that. Particularly, you're speaking about institutions that then may become a model in a certain way for other kinds of interactions. I mean, I think immediately of institutions. You were saying that some alternative institutions, you know, were specifically created by the state government in particular, but I'm thinking also of institutions in other places, for example, in the former Yugoslavia, where there's, the government is now playing less of a role, and before corporate sponsorship is coming in, that there is this opportunity for a different kind of model, and that actually is taking a lot of is actually an activist model, even more than necessarily a cultural model. And that brings me actually back around to the beginning, too, because it was interesting that John and Anselm were setting out different kinds of spaces or different kinds of institutions. The safe space, in a certain way, of the UN, whether or not that's actually true, and then the kind of free space of the alternative space, again, whether or not that's actually true, and that there is always a need to kind of go beyond itself, the institution, in order to kind of amass power, and how we kind of interact with that situation. And Tom was also mentioning that that there's not only an impossible representation or adequate representation of this power, but or evasion of power, but the impossible dialogue with power that I think is interesting. And I wanted to kind of ask John actually about this kind of impossibility of dialogue with power, and if there is in fact a kind of a gesture or a diplomatic gesture, kind of going back to Anselm's phrasing, that is that a role at all, the diplomatic gesture? Is that, how does that either create an evasion or take responsibility for an evasion? Is that any way of dealing? Is there anything in that diplomatic gesture that can get us anywhere? And I see the mailing list in some way as this gesture, this diplomatic gesture beyond itself, beyond the institution, the smaller institution. So that's the one question, and then we'll have another question just after John. Yeah, thank you. Well,
I think that, if I understand you correctly, the modalities of being diplomats is basically a way of not revealing the gaps or the gasps of power. You know, it's actually a refrain. It's an institutional refrain of the outbursts of power. And it's very interesting to notice how this self-refrain of the individual, of the diplomat, is immediately associated with the state power. And I am interested in more in this idea of the blockade of the expression, you know, the complete blankness of diplomats, rather than diplomatic gestures as ways of enabling any kind of negotiation.
So you think it's kind of, it's antithetical. It doesn't actually get, it just furthers the impossibility of the dialogue rather than actually providing an access point. Is if I'm understanding you
No,
correctly.
It is the moment of dialogue is the gasp. It's the moment where you refrain yourself. That is how it works. There's no dialogue through powerful institutions which is just played out completely. It's it's representing itself through refrain.
Yeah, or through a hiccup or something. Kind of, yeah, gasp. Go ahead, please.
Masked here for me is the idea that the neoliberal notion of equality in dialogue. I mean, what's evacuated from this question of dialogue, especially in cultural institutions, the problem is negotiation and inequality. So I think it's really interesting that all of you assume that dialogue is this positive. Well, actually, not, no, many of you question the notion of dialogue, but there isn't a move towards the alternative to dialogue, which I think would be negotiation. And the what subtends this this conversation is maybe what we were getting at in terms of the international good feeling, but I think that all of this reminds me of this section in Deleuze's book on Proust, where Deleuze says that Proust really hated dialogue, he hated philosophy, because there was precisely nothing at stake. And love, and for him, what mattered was love and the truths that were derived out of love and jealousy. And love and jealousy can be seen as these extreme states that have to do with radical intervention and dialogue, the conversation that he was having with, you know, that Marcel was trying to have with Saint Louis while he was trying to make Saint Louis go and find out the truth about his lover, was this mask for something else. And so the dialogue of sort of what puts the good thinking, the equal, really masks this neoliberal situation in which the cultural institution, alternative or not, is fully instrumentalized as part of a state program that masks inequality and promotes diversity. And I'll just stop there.
Does anybody respond first of all?
No, somehow the two models, no, jealousy and love, are both cannibalistic. No, they eat the other, you know. Certainly, I agree to basically with the notion of dialogue that you're attacking here. I would completely agree with that.
Does anybody else want to respond first? Okay, just one.
On Tom, your two prongs, you know, reading of the evasions of power. Go back to on one hand, you know, you were saying you evade power, the sort of possibility of some kind of innocent margin, of course. And then what I heard you saying the second one, but I just want to be sure, is that evasion is power. You know, that the classic tool of power is evasion. But even that, as it becomes powerful, you know, of course, lands in the crosshairs of you know, credible conflict. That its own power built on evasion. You know, sometimes finally, it's so psychologically weak that one can send in ricochet into that. But it even seemed to say that. Even these sort of benign art institutions, you too get your power by playing multiple masks. You're shifting your terms, and if you don't, you know, the frames of reference that you were talking about shut down, and it becomes a kind of monovalent voice. I mean, I suppose I wanted to say this because I didn't want to think that somehow to talk about this extra statecraft, some kind of benign area, like outside of trouble, or outside of power, but it is itself a sort of very lethal and dangerous form of power approach because it's not operating in terms with which we're familiar, which we see as politically authentic.
No, sorry, it's me again. I'm just like saying, you know, of course, what you're saying about the frame of reference, yes, of course. But I tried to make the point with the narrative, you know, and I couldn't really expand on that. But in the end, precisely the point is that it's not any narrative, right? It's a specific narrative that in kind of the relationship, that there is a tension, you know, like in any given situation, there is a specific kind of fault line, which is to be negotiated or not negotiated. And that is, you know, let's say the notion of the dialogue becomes interested when you actually lift it to the level of the pathologies of the imagination, of what you can imagine and what you can't, right? And then, you know, you could kind of break that down to bodily tensions, right, which kind of lead to a specific, you know, ability to be continuous or to kind of relate to something. And that's precisely what I mean with the story, and that the big difference is, you know, to this kind of free-floating image space in which you know, anything could appear, but it's for the sake of, you know, a fetish effect of visuality, which is absolutely indifferent. And that's exactly, you know, the point about the narrative. It's not any, not whatever.
But actually, Sergeant was first. Quick question for Tom about the video that you showed, and also about the comment about two dreams going hand in hand. I wanted to ask you, how do you, just in relation to the Lohansen set of breaking the image, right? That we actually also have a broken sound as well. And also that somehow I think in that video I saw, okay, you can see the, maybe the presentation of the dreams, but at the same time there were two realities in fact. The destruction of the building is an actual threat. The marketing is also an actual strategy. So can you kind of expand more about the connection between that video and the two dreams? And what is mediation? How can mediation be how can there be a degree of mediation instead of being total mediation?
Yeah. I don't know if I can make the connection, but I can certainly agree with you on that conclusion. There are in the same way that there are many different forms of power, and obviously all exercises and all forms of power are not equivalent. Likewise, there are all sorts of different mediations and different forms of mediation. The phenomenon may be represented by that tape, or at least one of the phenomena represented by that tape, I would describe as the indissociability of the event and its representation. I think to a considerable degree you can say that the event occurred in order to be represented. The military quality of the target was rather minimal. It was a stable object to be blown up for a stable camera. And the significance, the politico-military significance of the event is largely measured by the dissemination, by the branding of the videotape, by its traffic through these networks and so on. That's where the action is. So yeah, an event happened, but an event also happened in the or with or by means of the videotape. And it seems to me that's, in fact, where a great deal of the question of power is in the transport and the dissemination, to use Catherine's word, of it, if that helped.
You're talking about the delay.
The staging, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a highly aesthetic product there, yeah.
But Tom, take that action, and you've made a connection between the global jihad and some of NGOs out of the context of a stage theory? So, I mean, we know already...
Stage theory?
Stage theory. Such as the Mao three-stage theory, right, of insurrection. That outrage is, in fact, forming communities, right? Your relation mm-hmm. to outrage, mm-hmm. Whether in support or against, is what defines your kind of political position within a particular system, right? So not only mobilizing, but actually forming political communities, but in fact, as is with the jihad, this is a part of effectively a stage theory. I mean, it's not a non-state institution. There is a desire to create a kind of caliphate or any other kind of finally territorial-based political system. So I wonder in what way you see that kind of breaking out of the model of kind of more traditional model of terrorism and insurrection.
Yeah. I guess it depends on how seriously you take the putative desire for a re-establishment of the caliphate. I find it kind of hard to believe. So a kind of like simulacrum of a political goal, a quasi. But I don't know what exactly the right word is. So maybe, for lack of a better one, a crude one, like fraudulent. It seems to me it's a kind of non-political project dressing up as a political project. I'm not 100% sure. I find it's something like the problem that I was addressing in the thing that David quoted. I find it. There's a borderline between, there's a shared problem between the jihad and the, NGO, which is that the line between politics and non-politics, or politics and anti-politics, is extremely blurry. So in a certain sense, humanitarian projects, I mean, we'd all say, it's related to what John was saying about neutrality. I mean, is a neutral space a political space or a non-political space or an anti-political space? You can answer all of those questions and talk for a long time about it. So there's a phenomenon, we're living in a phenomenon where those lines, I think, are extremely difficult to mark. I'm pushing on the one side, on the anti-political. I think it's interesting and important to interpret a number of these projects as in some sense opposed to the existence of a political sphere. So that we can figure out what the political sphere might look like or something.
But don't they in fact as well constitute an insider and outside of a political sphere, yeah, such as effectively constituting a political community in relation to their action?
Effectively constituting a community, yes. Its political character is for me the big mystery. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We actually have time just for one more question, so go ahead.
And as I was listening to your story, which was also deeply personal, where is the sort of the power of the personal narrative in this? As we were, because we all have the stories, and I think this is how we relate to each other. And so I think there's a lot of power in that, not so much like political or global or.
Mm-hmm. Maybe David and maybe also Anselm could speak to that.
Well, I guess I'd be more interested in the risk of the personal story. I mean, one of the problems to me with the institutionalized discourse of genocide is the way that it, that I didn't talk about in this, but in the way that it relentlessly converts something we might want to call witnessing or testimony into proof and evidence, experience, right? And so, you know, very practically, for instance, we have this situation in the U.S. where there's tons of archives in L.A. at Columbia University of stories of the Armenian genocide, but nobody has begun to think about how to read them. What would it mean to read them? We wouldn't even know how to read them. They're just sitting there, made inert as the personal to function in one tone, and that is as evidence or proof or kind of juridical case that's what genocide turns catastrophe into, I think. So what would it even mean to think the personal outside of that frame? That's like the beginning of a question, you know what I mean? That's what I'm interested in, rather than rushing too quickly. So I think we rush too quickly into the personal or that. It might be a different kind of personal than you're talking about, but that's something that occurs to me.
I would as well insist on the tension between, you know, the necessity of the masquerade on the one hand, and kind of, you know, to not undo that tension between, you know, the desire for the authentic, which always goes along with any narrative, and which can just lead to another kind of fetishization, which, you know, could produce the same kind of white noise like the image at the moment, I believe, but it does less run into that same danger. But I think that, you know, one should always kind of see that desire for the authentic in relation to the necessity of the masquerade. You know, like that kind of perspective that would always try to look at the framing device, there is as well, you know, the same problem occurs there. It's, you know, that there is a second kind of level of the authentic critique, no? Like, let's get kind of... there's a lot of that in kind of post-colonial critique, no? Like, of a second level of undoing the ideology of kind of naturalized behavior patterns, etc. We didn't really manage to get over that, no? And I believe that is absolute... What we encounter there is really a carnival. And, you know, a carnival in the sense of the monsters that dwell in every kind of margins. And I think, you know, the thing why I stressed the theater here is, in a Brecht sense, you know, it was said that in the end, who learned from Brecht's experiments was never the audience, right? It was never the audience can never undo with its desire for authenticity, for something to happen, right? And for this hypnosis. It's always the actors that learn.
I can see wanting to refresh political orthodoxies. You know, I don't know if that's what you mean. Is that what you mean? What you mean by that?
No, I mean a project that's anti-political would be, if you imagine the political has to take place in some kind of space and time, it is conceivable to have projects which target for destruction the space in which political activity occurs. Well, the question is...
Well, this may be exactly this evasion.